Edclinth thought long and hard about how to proceed. After 5 days of investigations, Figueroa had given him a number of indisputable indications that something was rotten within SIS. He recognized the need to move very carefully until he had enough information. He found himself, furthermore, with a constitutional dilemma. He did not have the authority to conduct secret investigations, and most assuredly not against his colleagues. Accordingly, he had to contrive some cause that would legitimize what he was doing. If worst came to worst, he could always fall back on the fact that it was a policeman's duty to investigate a crime. But the breach was now so sensitive from a constitutional standpoint that he would surely be fired if he took a single wrong step. So he spent the whole of Friday brooding alone in his office. Finally, he concluded that Armansky was right, no matter how improbable it might seem. There really was a conspiracy inside SIS, and a number of individuals were acting outside of or parallel to regular operations. Because this had been going on for many years, at least since 1976, when Zarachenko arrived in Sweden, it had to be organized and sanctioned from the top. Exactly how high the conspiracy went, he had no idea. He wrote 3 names on a pad. Gurren Mortensen, Personal Protection, Criminal Inspector. Gunnar Björk, Assistant Chief of Immigration Division. Deceased. Suicide. Albert Schenker, Chief of Secretariat, SIS. Figueroa was of the view that the Chief of Secretariat must have been calling the shots when Mortensen in Personal Protection was supposedly moved to counter-espionage, although he was not in fact working there. He was too busy monitoring the movements of journalist Mikhail Blomqvist, and that didn't have anything at all to do with the operations of counter-espionage. Some other names from outside SIS had to be added to the list. Peter Teleborian, psychiatrist. Lars Falsen, locksmith. Teleborian had been hired by SIS as a psychiatric consultant on specific cases in the late 80s and early 90s, on 3 occasions to be exact, and Edclinth had examined the reports in the archive. The first had been extraordinary. Counter-espionage had identified a Russian informer inside the Swedish telecom industry, and the spy's background indicated that he might be inclined to suicide in the event that his actions were exposed. Teleborian had done a strikingly good analysis, which helped them turn the informer so that he could become a double agent. His other 2 reports had involved less significant evaluations. One was of an employee inside SIS who had an alcohol problem, and the second was an analysis of the bizarre sexual behaviour of an African diplomat. Neither Teleborian nor Falsen, especially not Falsen, had any position inside SIS. And yet, through their assignments, they were connected to what? The conspiracy was intimately linked to the late Alexander Zarachenko, the defected GRU agent who had apparently turned up in Sweden on election day in 1976, a man no one had ever heard of before. How was that possible? Edclinth tried to imagine what reasonably would have happened if he had been sitting at the chief's desk at SIS in 1976 when Zarachenko defected. What would he have done? Absolute secrecy would have been essential. The defection could only be known to a small group, without risking that the information might leak back to the Russians, and how small a group? An operations department? An unknown operations department? If the affair had been appropriately handled, Zarachenko's case should have ended up in counter-espionage. Ideally, he should have come under the auspices of the Military Intelligence Service, but they had neither the resources nor the expertise to run this sort of operational activity, so SIS it was. But counter-espionage never had him. Björk was the key. He had been one of the people who handled Zarachenko. And yet Björk never had anything to do with counter-espionage. Björk was a mystery. Officially, he had held a post in the Immigration Division since the 70s, but in reality he had scarcely been seen in the department before the 90s, when suddenly he became assistant chief. And yet Björk was the primary source of Blomqvist's information. How had Blomqvist been able to persuade Björk to reveal such explosive material? And to a journalist at that. Prostitutes. Björk messed around with teenage prostitutes, and Millennium was going to expose him. Blomqvist must have blackmailed Björk. Then Salander came into the picture. The deceased lawyer Niels Bjurman worked in the immigration division at the same time as the deceased Bjork. They were the ones who had taken care of Zalachenko. But what did they do with him? Somebody must have made the decision. With a defector of such importance, the order must have come from the highest level. From the government. It must have been backed by the government. Anything else would be unthinkable. Ed Klinth felt cold shivers of apprehension. This was all conceivable in practice. It made sense. But what happened in 1991 did not make sense. Bjork had hired Teleborian to lock Salander up in a psychiatric hospital for children under the pretense that she was mentally deranged. That was a crime. That was such a monstrous crime that Ed Klinth felt yet more apprehensive. Somebody must have made that decision. It simply could not have been the government. Ingvar Carlsson had been Prime Minister at the time, and then Carl Bildt. But no politician would dare to be involved in such a decision, which contradicted all law and justice, and which would result in a disastrous scandal if it were ever discovered. If the government was involved, then Sweden wasn't one iota better than any dictatorship in the entire world. It was impossible. And what about the events of April 12th? Zalachenko was conveniently murdered at Sahlgrenska Hospital by a mentally ill fanatic at the same time as a burglary was committed at Blomqvist's apartment and advocate Giannini was mugged. In both latter instances, copies of Bjork's strange report dating from 1991 were stolen. Armansky had contributed this information, but it was completely off the record. No police report was ever filed. And at the same time, Bjork, a person with whom Ed Klinth wished he could have had a serious talk, hangs himself. Ed Klinth didn't believe in coincidence on such a grand scale. Inspector Bublansky didn't believe in it either. Neither did Blomqvist. Ed Klinth took up his felt pen once more. Evert Gulberg, 78 years old, tax specialist. 3 question marks. Who the hell was Evert Gulberg? He considered calling up the chief of SIS, but restrained himself for the simple reason that he did not know how far up in the organization the conspiracy reached. He didn't know whom to trust. For a moment he considered turning to the regular police. Jan Bublansky was the leader of the investigation concerning Ronald Niedermann, and obviously he would be interested in any related information, but from a purely political standpoint it was out of the question. He felt a great weight on his shoulders. There was only one constitutionally correct option left, which might provide some protection if he ended up in hot water. He would have to turn to the chief to secure political support for what he was working on. It was just before 4 on Friday afternoon. He picked up the phone and called the Minister of Justice, whom he had known for many years and had dealings with at numerous departmental meetings. He got him on the line within 5 minutes.
"Hello, Torsten. It's been a long time. What's the problem?"
"To tell you the truth, I think I'm calling to check how much credibility I have with you."
"Credibility? That's a peculiar question. As far as I'm concerned, you have absolute credibility. What makes you ask such a dramatic question?"
"It's prompted by a dramatic and extraordinary request. I need to have a meeting with you and the Prime Minister, and it's urgent."
"Whoa."
"If you'll forgive me, I'd rather explain when we can talk in private. Something so remarkable came across my desk that I believe both you and the Prime Minister need to be informed."
"Does it have anything to do with terrorists and threat assessment?"
"No. It's more serious than that. I'm putting my reputation and career on the line by calling you with this request."
"I see. That's why you asked about your credibility. How soon do you need the meeting with the PM?"
"This evening, if possible."
"Now you've got me worried."
"Unfortunately, there's good reason for you to be worried."
"How long will the meeting take?"
"Probably an hour."
"Let me call you back."
The Minister of Justice called back 10 minutes later and said that the Prime Minister would meet with Ed Klinth at his residence at 9:30 that evening. Ed Klinth's palms were sweating when he put down the phone.
"By tomorrow morning my career could be over."
He called Figueroa.
"Hello, Monica. At 9 tonight you have to report for duty. You'd better dress nicely."
"I always dress nicely," Figueroa said.
The Prime Minister gave the Director of Constitutional Protection a long, wary look. Ed Klinth had a sense that cogs were whirring at high speed behind the PM's glasses. The PM shifted his gaze to Figueroa,
who hadn't said a word during the presentation. He saw an unusually tall and muscular woman looking back at him with a polite, expectant expression. Then he turned to the Minister of Justice, who had paled over the course of the presentation. Then the PM took a deep breath, removed his glasses, and stared for a moment into the distance.
"I think we need a little more coffee," he said.
"Yes, please," Figueroa said.
Ed Clinth nodded, and the Minister of Justice poured coffee from a thermos carafe.
"Let me be absolutely certain I understood you correctly," the Prime Minister said. "You suspect that there's a conspiracy within the security police that is acting outside its constitutional mandate, and that over the years this conspiracy has committed what could be categorized as serious criminal acts?"
"Yes."
"And you're coming to me because you don't trust the leadership of the security police?"
"No, not exactly,"
Ed Clinth said.
"I decided to turn directly to you because this sort of activity is unconstitutional. But I don't know the objective of the conspiracy or whether I've misinterpreted something. For all I know, the activity may be legitimate and sanctioned by the government. Then I risk proceeding on faulty information, thereby compromising some secret operation."
The Prime Minister looked at the Minister of Justice. Both understood that Ed Clinth was hedging his bets.
"I've never heard of anything like this. Do you know anything about it?"
"Absolutely not," the Minister of Justice said. "There's nothing in any report I've seen from the security police that could have a bearing on this matter."
"Blomquist thinks there's a faction within SEPO. He refers to it as the Zalachenko Club," Ed Clinth said.
"I'd never even heard that Sweden had taken in and protected a Russian defector of such importance," the PM said.
"He defected during the Feldin administration, you say?"
"I don't believe Feldin would have covered up something like this," the Minister of Justice said. "This kind of defection would have been given the highest priority and would have been passed over to the next administration."
Ed Clinth cleared his throat.
"Feldin's conservative government was succeeded by Olof Palme's. It's no secret that some of my predecessors at SIS had a certain opinion of Palme."
"You're suggesting that somebody forgot to inform the Social Democratic government?"
Ed Clinth nodded.
"Let's remember that Feldin was in power for 2 separate mandates. Each time, the coalition government collapsed. First, he handed over to Ola Ullsten, who had a minority government in 1979. The government collapsed again when the moderates jumped ship, and Feldin governed together with the People's Party. I'm guessing that the government secretariat was in turmoil during those transition periods. It's also possible that knowledge of Zalachenko was confined to so small a circle that Prime Minister Feldin had no real oversight, so he never had anything to hand over to Palme."
"In that case, who's responsible?" the PM said.
All except Figueroa shook their heads.
"I assume this is bound to leak to the media," the PM said. "Blomquist and Millennium are going to publish it. In other words, we are caught between the proverbial rock and hard place."
Ed Clinth was careful to use the word "we." The PM nodded. He realized the gravity of the situation.
"Then I'll have to start by thanking you for coming to me with this matter as soon as you did. I don't usually agree to this sort of unscheduled meeting, but the Minister here said that you were a prudent person, and that something serious must have happened if you wanted to see me outside all normal channels."
Ed Clinth exhaled a little. Whatever happened, the wrath of the Prime Minister was not going to come down on him.
"Now we just have to decide how we're going to handle it. Do you have any suggestions?"
"Perhaps,"
Ed Clinth said tentatively. He was silent for so long that Figueroa cleared her throat.
"May I say something?"
"Please do,"
the PM said.
"If it's true that the government doesn't know about this operation, then it's illegal. The person responsible in such a case is the criminal civil servant, or civil servants, who overstepped his authority. If we can verify all the claims Blomquist is making, it means that a group of officers within SIS have been devoting themselves to criminal activity for a long time. The problem would then unfold in 2 parts."
"How do you mean?"
"First, we have to ask the question, how could this have been possible? Who is responsible? How did such a conspiracy develop within the framework of an established police organization? I myself work for SIS, and I'm proud of it. How can this have gone on for so long? How could this activity have been both concealed and financed?"
"Go on,"
the PM said. Whole books will probably be written about this first part. It's clear that there must have been financing, at least several million kroner annually, I'd say. I looked over the budget of the security police and found nothing resembling an allocation for the Zalachenko Club. But as you know, there are a number of hidden funds, controlled by the Chief of Secretariat and Chief of Budget, that I have no access to. The Prime Minister nodded grimly. Why did Seppo always have to be such a nightmare to administer? The second part is, who is involved? And very specifically, which individuals should be arrested? From my standpoint, the answers to all these questions depend on the decision you make in the next few minutes, she said to the PM. Ed Clinth was holding his breath. If he could have kicked Figueroa in the shin, he would have done so. She had cut through all the rhetoric and intimated that the Prime Minister himself was responsible. He had considered coming to the same conclusion, but not before a long and diplomatic circumlocution.
What decision do you think I should make?
I believe we have common interests. I've worked at Constitutional Protection for 3 years. I consider this office of central importance to Swedish democracy. The security police has worked satisfactorily within the framework of the Constitution in recent years. Naturally, I don't want the scandal to affect SIS. For us, it's important to bear in mind that this is a case of criminal activity perpetrated by a small number of individuals.
Activity of this kind is most definitely not sanctioned by the government, the Minister of Justice said.
Figueroa nodded and thought for a few seconds. It is, in my view, essential that the scandal should not implicate the government, which is what would happen if the government tried to suppress the story.
The government does not cover up criminal activity, the Minister of Justice said.
No, but let's assume, hypothetically, that the government might want to do so. There would be a scandal of enormous proportions.
Go on, the PM said.
The situation is complicated by the fact that we in Constitutional Protection are being forced to conduct an operation which is itself against regulations in order to investigate this matter. So we want everything to be legitimate and in keeping with the Constitution.
As do we all, the PM said.
In that case, I suggest that you, in your capacity as Prime Minister, instruct Constitutional Protection to investigate this mess with the utmost urgency, Figueroa said. Give us a written order and the authority we need.
I'm not sure that what you propose is legal, the Minister of Justice said.
It is legal. The government has the power to adopt a wide range of measures in the event that breaches of the Constitution are threatened. If a group from the military or police starts pursuing an independent foreign policy, a de facto coup has taken place in Sweden.
Foreign policy? The Minister of Justice said.
The PM nodded all of a sudden. Zalachenko was a defector from a foreign power, Figueroa said. The information he contributed was supplied, according to Blomqvist, to foreign intelligence services. If the government was not informed, a coup has taken place.
I follow your reasoning, the PM said. Now let me say my piece.
He got up and walked once around the table before stopping in front of Ed Clinth.
You have a very talented colleague. She has hit the nail on the head.
Ed Clinth swallowed and nodded. The PM turned to the Minister of Justice.
Get in touch with the Under-Secretary of State and the head of the legal department. By tomorrow morning I want a document drawn up granting the Constitutional Protection Unit extraordinary authority to act in this matter. Their assignment is to determine the truth behind the assertions we have discussed, to gather documentation about its extent, and to identify the individuals responsible or in any way involved. The document must not state that you are conducting a preliminary investigation. I may be wrong, but I think only the Prosecutor General could appoint a preliminary investigation leader in this situation. But I can give you the authority to conduct a one-man investigation. What you are doing is therefore an official public report. Do you understand?
Yes, but I should point out that I myself am a former prosecutor.
We'll have to ask the head of the legal department to take a look at this and determine exactly what is formally correct. In any case, you alone are responsible for your investigation. You will choose the assistance you require. If you find evidence of criminal activity, you must turn this information over to the PG, who will decide on the charges.
I'll have to look up exactly what applies, but I think you'll have to inform the Speaker of Parliament and the Constitutional Committee. This is going to leak out fast, the Minister of Justice said.
In other words, we have to work faster, the PM said.
Figueroa raised a hand.
"What is it?" the PM said. "There are two problems remaining. First, will Millennium's publication clash with our investigation? And second, Lisbeth Salander's trial will be starting in a couple of weeks."
"Can we find out when Millennium's going to publish?"
"We could ask,"
Edclinth said.
"The last thing we want to do is to interfere with the press."
"With regard to this girl Salander,"
the Minister of Justice began, and then he paused for a moment.
"It would be terrible if she really has been subjected to the injustices that Millennium claims. Could it be possible?"
"I'm afraid it is," Edclinth said.
"In that case, we have to see to it that she is given redress for these wrongs, and above all that she is not subjected to new injustices," the PM said.
"And how would that work?" asked the Minister of Justice. "The government cannot interfere in an ongoing prosecution case. That would be against the law."
"Could we talk to the prosecutor?"
"No,"
Edclinth said. "As Prime Minister, you may not influence the judicial process in any way."
"In other words, Salander will have to take her chances in court," the Minister of Justice said. "Only if she loses the trial and appeals to the government can the government step in and pardon her, or require the PG to investigate whether there are grounds for a new trial. But this applies only if she's sentenced to prison. If she's sentenced to a secure psychiatric facility, the government cannot do a thing. Then it's a medical matter, and the Prime Minister has no jurisdiction to determine whether or not she is sane."
At 10 on Friday night, Salander heard the key turn in the door. She instantly switched off her palm and slipped it under the mattress. When she looked up, she saw Jonasson closing the door.
"Good evening, Fröken Salander," he said, "and how are you doing this evening?"
"I have a splitting headache and I feel feverish."
"That doesn't sound so good."
Salander looked to be not particularly bothered by either the fever or the headache. Jonasson spent 10 minutes examining her. He noticed that over the course of the evening her fever had again risen dramatically.
"It's a shame that you should be having this setback, when you've been recovering so well over the past few weeks.
Unfortunately, I now won't be able to discharge you for at least 2 more weeks.
2 weeks should be sufficient."
The distance by land from London to Stockholm is roughly 1,180 miles. In theory, that would be about 20 hours' driving. In fact, it had taken almost 20 hours to reach the northern border of Germany with Denmark. The sky was filled with leaden thunderclouds, and when the man known as Trinity found himself on Sunday in the middle of the Øresundsbron, there was a downpour. He slowed and turned on his windshield wipers. Trinity thought it was sheer hell driving in Europe, since everyone on the continent insisted on driving on the wrong side of the road. He had packed his van on Friday morning and taken the ferry from Dover to Calais, then crossed Belgium by way of Liège. He crossed the German border at Aachen, and then took the Autobahn north towards Hamburg and on to Denmark. His companion, Bob the dog, was asleep in the back. They had taken turns driving, and apart from a couple of hour-long stops along the way, they had maintained a steady 55 miles an hour. The van was 18 years old and wasn't able to go much faster anyway. There were easier ways of getting from London to Stockholm, but it wasn't likely that he would be able to take more than 60 pounds of electronic gear on a normal flight. They had crossed 6 national borders, but they had not been stopped once, either by customs or by passport control. Trinity was an ardent fan of the EU, whose regulations simplified his visits to the continent. Trinity had been born in Bradford, but he had lived in North London since childhood. He had had a miserable formal education and then attended a vocational school and earned a certificate as a trained telecommunications technician. For 3 years after his 19th birthday, he had worked as an engineer for British Telecom. Once he understood how the telephone network functioned and realized how hopelessly antiquated it was, he switched to being a private security consultant, installing alarm systems and managing burglary protection. For special clients, he would also offer his video surveillance and telephone tapping services. Now 32 years old, he had a theoretical knowledge of electronics and computer science that allowed him to challenge any professor in the field. He had lived with computers since he was 10, and he hacked his first computer when he was 13. It had whetted his appetite, and when he was 16, he had advanced to the extent that he could compete with the best in the world. There was a period in which he spent every waking minute in front of his computer screen, writing his own programs and planting insidious tendrils on the Internet. He infiltrated the BBC, the Ministry of Defence, and Scotland Yard. He even managed, for a short time, to take command of a nuclear submarine on patrol in the North Sea. It was for the best that Trinity belonged to the inquisitive rather than the malicious type of computer marauder. His fascination was extinguished the moment he had cracked a computer, gained access, and appropriated its secrets. He was one of the founders of Hacker Republic, and WASP was one of its citizens. It was 7:30 on Sunday evening as he and Bob the dog approached Stockholm. When they passed IKEA at Kungenskurve in Skärholmen, Trinity flipped open his mobile and dialed a number he had memorized.
"Plague," Trinity said.
"Where are you guys?"
"You said to call when we passed IKEA."
Plague gave him directions to the youth hostel on Longholmen, where he had booked a room for his colleagues from England. Since Plague hardly ever left his apartment, they agreed to meet at his place at 10 the next morning. Plague decided to make an exceptional effort and washed the dishes, generally cleaned up, and opened the windows in anticipation of his guest's arrival. Part 3. Disc Crash. May 27th to June 6th. The historian Diodorus from Sicily, 2nd century BC, who is regarded as an unreliable source by other historians, describes the Amazons of Libya, which at that time was a name used for all of North Africa west of Egypt. This Amazon reign was a gynecocracy, that is, only women were allowed to hold high office, including in the military. According to legend, the realm was ruled by Queen Marina, who, with 30,000 female soldiers and 3,000 female cavalry, swept through Egypt and Syria and all the way to the Aegean, defeating a number of male armies along the way. After Queen Marina finally fell in battle, her army scattered. But the army did leave its imprint on the region. The women of Anatolia took to the sword to crush an invasion from the Caucasus after the male soldiers were all slaughtered in a far-reaching genocide. These women trained in the use of all types of weapons, including bow and arrow, spear, battle axe, and lance. They copied their bronze breastplates and armour from the Greeks. They rejected marriage as subjugation. So that they might have children, they were granted a leave of absence, during which they copulated with randomly selected males from nearby towns. Only a woman who had killed a man in battle was allowed to give up her virginity. Chapter 16. Friday, May 27th to Tuesday, May 31st. Blomqvist left the Millennium offices at 10:30 on Friday night. He took the stairs down to the ground floor, but instead of going out onto the street, he turned left and went through the basement, across the inner courtyard, and through the building behind theirs onto Hökensgata. He ran into a group of youths on their way from Mosebacke, but no one seemed to be paying him any attention. Anyone watching the building would think that he was spending the night at Millennium, as he often did. He had established the pattern as early as April. Actually, it was Mom who had the night shift. He spent 15 minutes walking down the alleys and boulevards around Mosebacke before he headed for Fiskargarten 9. He opened the door using the code and took the stairs to the top-floor apartment, where he used Salander's keys to get in. He turned off the alarm. He always felt a bit bemused when he went into the apartment. 21 rooms, of which only 3 were furnished. He made coffee and sandwiches before he went into Salander's office and booted up her power book. From the moment in mid-April when Björk's report was stolen and Blomqvist realized he was under surveillance, he had established his own headquarters at Salander's apartment. He had transferred the most crucial documentation to her desk. He spent several nights a week at the apartment, slept in her bed and worked on her computer. She had wiped her hard drive clean before she left for Gossenberger and the confrontation with Zarachenko. Blomqvist supposed that she had not planned to come back. He had used her system disks to restore her computer to a functioning state. Since April, he had not even plugged in the broadband cable to his own machine. He logged onto her broadband connection, started up the ICQ chat program, and pinged up the address she had created for him through the Yahoo group idiotic_table.
"Hi, Sally."
"Talk to me."
"I've been working on the 2 chapters we discussed earlier this week. New version is on Yahoo. How's it going with you?"
"Finished with 17 pages. Uploading now."
Ping.
Okay, got 'em. Let me read, then we'll talk later.
I've got more.
More what?
I created another Yahoo group called The_Knights.
Blomqvist smiled.
The Knights of the Idiotic Table.
Password YACARACA12. Four members. You, me, Plague and Trinity.
Your mysterious nighttime buddies.
Protection.
Okay.
Plague has copied info from Prosecutor Ekstrom's computer. We hacked it in April. If I lose the palm, he'll keep you informed.
Good. Thanks. Blomqvist logged into ICQ and went into the newly created Yahoo group The_Knights. All he found was a link from Plague to an anonymous URL which consisted solely of numbers. He copied the address into Explorer, hit the return key, and came to a website somewhere on the internet that contained the 16 gigabytes of Ekstrom's hard drive. Plague had obviously made it simple for himself by copying over Ekstrom's entire hard drive, and Blomqvist spent more than an hour sorting through its contents. He ignored the system files, software, and endless files containing preliminary investigations that seemed to stretch back several years. He downloaded four folders. Three of them were called prelim.inv/Salander, /Salander, and prelim.inv/Niedemann. The fourth was a copy of Ekstrom's email folder made at 2 p.m. the previous day.
Thanks, Plague, Blomqvist said to himself.
He spent 3 hours reading through Ekstrom's preliminary investigation and strategy for the trial. Not surprisingly, much of it dealt with Salander's mental state. Ekstrom wanted an extensive psychiatric examination and had sent a lot of messages with the object of getting her transferred to Kronoberg prison as a matter of urgency. Blomqvist could tell that Ekstrom was making no headway in his search for Niedemann. Poblansky was the leader of that investigation. He had succeeded in gathering some forensic evidence linking Niedemann to the murders of Svensson and Johansson, as well as to the murder of Bjurman. Blomqvist's own 3 long interviews in April had set them on the trail of this evidence. If Niedemann were ever apprehended, Blomqvist would have to be a witness for the prosecution. At long last, DNA from sweat droplets and 2 hairs from Bjurman's apartment were matched to items from Niedemann's room in Gossenberger. The same DNA was found in abundant quantities on the remains of Svavelsjö MC's Göransson. On the other hand, Ekstrom had remarkably little on the record about Zalachenko. Blomqvist lit a cigarette and stood by the window looking out towards Djurgården. Ekstrom was leading 2 separate preliminary investigations. Criminal Inspector Faste was the investigative leader in all matters dealing with Salander. Poblansky was working only on Niedemann. When the name Zalachenko turned up in the preliminary investigation, the logical thing for Ekstrom to do would have been to contact the General Director of the Security Police to determine who Zalachenko actually was. Blomqvist could find no such inquiry in Ekstrom's email, journal, or notes. But among the notes, Blomqvist found several cryptic sentences. The Salander investigation is fake. Björk's original doesn't match Blomqvist's version. Classify top secret. Then a series of notes claiming that Salander was paranoid and a schizophrenic. Correct to lock up Salander, 1991. He found what linked the investigations in the Salander slush, that is, the supplementary information that the prosecutor considered irrelevant to the preliminary investigation, and which would therefore not be presented at the trial or make up part of the chain of evidence against her. This included almost everything that had to do with Zalachenko's background. The investigation was totally inadequate. Blomqvist wondered to what extent this was a coincidence and to what extent it was contrived. Where was the boundary? And was Ekstrom aware that there was a boundary? Could it be that someone was deliberately supplying Ekstrom with believable but misleading information? Finally, Blomqvist logged into Hotmail and spent 10 minutes checking the half-dozen anonymous email accounts he had created. Each day he had checked the address he had given to Criminal Inspector Modig. He had no great hope that she would contact him, so he was mildly surprised when he opened the inbox and found an email from resolskap9april@hotmail.com. The message consisted of a single line. Café Madeleine, upper level, 11 a.m, Saturday. Plague pinged Salander at midnight and interrupted her in the middle of a sentence she was writing about her time with Holger Palmgren as her guardian. She cast an irritated glance at the display.
What do you want?
Hi, Wasp. Nice to hear from you, too.
Yeah, what is it?
Teleborian.
She sat up in bed and looked eagerly at the screen of her palm.
Tell me.
Trinity fixed it in record time.
How?
The crazy doctor won't stay in one place. He travels between Uppsala and Stockholm all the time, and we can't do a hostile takeover.
I know. How?
He plays tennis twice a week, about 2 hours. Left his computer in the car in a garage.
Aha!
Trinity easily disabled the car alarm to get the computer. Took him 30 minutes to copy everything via Firewire and install Asphyxia.
Where?
Plague gave her the URL of the server where he kept Teleborian's hard drive. To quote Trinity, this is one nasty shit.
Question mark?
Check his hard drive. Salander disconnected from Plague and accessed the server he had directed her to. She spent nearly 3 hours scrutinizing folder after folder on Teleborian's computer. She found correspondence between Teleborian and a person with a Hotmail address who sent encrypted email. Since she had access to Teleborian's PGP key, she easily decoded the correspondence. His name was Jonas. No last name. Jonas and Teleborian had an unhealthy interest in seeing that Salander did not thrive.
Yes, we can prove that there is a conspiracy.
But what really interested Salander were the 47 folders containing close to 9,000 photographs of explicit child pornography. She clicked on image after image of children aged about 15 or younger. A number of pictures were of infants. The majority were of girls. Many of them were sadistic. She found links to at least a dozen people abroad who traded child porn with one another. Salander bit her lip, but her face was otherwise expressionless. She remembered the nights when, as a 12-year-old, she had been strapped down in a stimulus-free room at St. Stephen's. Teleborian had come into the room again and again to look at her in the glow of the nightlight. She knew. He had never touched her, but she had always known. She should have dealt with Teleborian years ago, but she had repressed the memory of him. She had chosen to ignore his existence. After a while, she pinged Blomqvist on ICQ. Blomqvist spent the night at Salander's apartment on Fiskegarten. He did not shut down the computer until 6:30 a.m. and fell asleep with photographs of gross child pornography whirling through his mind. He woke at 10:15 and rolled out of Salander's bed, showered and called a taxi to pick him up outside Södra Theatre. He got out at Birger Jarlsgarten at 10:55 and walked to Café Madeleine. Modig was waiting for him with a cup of black coffee in front of her.
"Hi," Blomqvist said.
"I'm taking a big risk here,"
she said without greeting.
"Nobody will hear of our meeting from me."
She seemed stressed.
"One of my colleagues recently went to see former Prime Minister Feldin. He went there on his own initiative, and his job is on the line now too."
"I understand."
"I need a guarantee of anonymity for both of us."
"I don't even know which colleague you're talking about."
"I'll tell you later. I want you to promise to give him protection as a source."
"You have my word."
She looked at her watch.
"Are you in a hurry?"
"Yes. I have to meet my husband and kids at the Stora Gallerian in 10 minutes. He thinks I'm still at work."
"And Bublansky knows nothing about this?"
"No."
"Right. You and your colleague are sources, and you have complete source protection. Both of you. As long as you live."
"My colleague is Jerka Holmberg. You met him down in Göteborg. His father is a Centre Party member, and Jerka has known Prime Minister Feldin since he was a child. He seems to be pleasant enough, so Jerka went to see him and asked about Zalachenko."
Blomqvist's heart began to pound.
"Jerka asked Feldin what he knew about the defection, but Feldin didn't reply. When Holmberg told him that we suspect Salander was locked up by the people who are protecting Zalachenko, well, that really upset him."
"Did he say how much he knew?"
"Feldin told him that the chief of SEPO at the time and a colleague came to visit him very soon after he became Prime Minister. They told a fantastic story about a Russian defector who had come to Sweden, told him that it was the most sensitive military secret Sweden possessed, that there was nothing in Swedish military intelligence that was anywhere near as important. Feldin said he didn't know how to handle it, that there was no one with much experience in government, the Social Democrats having been in power for more than 40 years. He was advised that he alone had to make the decisions, and that if he discussed it with his government colleagues, then SEPO would wash their hands of it. He remembered the whole thing as being very unpleasant."
"What did he do?"
"He realized he had no choice but to do what the gentleman from SEPO proposed. He issued a directive, putting SEPO in sole charge of the defector. He pledged never to discuss the matter with anyone. Feldin was never ever told Zadachenko's name."
"Extraordinary."
After that, he heard almost nothing more during his 2 terms in office. But he did do something extremely shrewd. He insisted that an Under-Secretary of State be let in on the secret in case there was a need for a go-between for the government secretariat and those who were protecting Zalachenko.
Did he remember who it was?
It was Bertil K. Jännerud, now Swedish ambassador in The Hague. When it was explained to Feldin how serious this preliminary investigation was, he sat down and wrote to Jännerud.
Modig pushed an envelope across the table.
Dear Bertil, the secret we both protected during my administration is now the subject of some very serious questions. The person referred to in the matter is now deceased and can no longer come to harm, but other people can. It is of the utmost importance that we obtain answers to the necessary questions. The person who bears this letter is working unofficially and has my trust. I urge you to listen to his story and answer his questions. Use your famous good judgment. T.F.
This letter is referring to Holmberg?
No. Jerke asked Feldin not to put in a name. He said that he couldn't know who would be going to The Hague.
You mean...
Jerke and I have discussed it. We're already out on ice so thin that we'll need paddles rather than ice picks. We have no authority to travel to Holland to interview the ambassador. But you could do it.
Blomqvist folded the letter and was putting it into his jacket pocket when Modig grabbed his hand. Her grip was hard.
Information for information, she said. We want to hear everything Jännerud tells you.
Blomqvist nodded. Modig stood up. Hang on. You said that Feldin was visited by 2 people from Seppo. One was the chief of Seppo. Who was the other?
Feldin met him only on that one occasion and couldn't remember his name. No notes were taken at the meeting. He remembered him as thin with a narrow moustache. But he did recall that the man was introduced as the boss of the Section for Special Analysis, or something like that. Feldin later looked at an organisational chart of Seppo and couldn't find that department.
The Zalachenko Club, Blomqvist thought. Modig seemed to be weighing her words.
At the risk of ending up dead, she said at last, there is one record that neither Feldin nor his visitors thought of.
What was that?
Feldin's visitor's logbook at Rosenbad. Jerke requisitioned it. It's a public document.
And? Modig hesitated once again.
The book states only that the Prime Minister met with the chief of Seppo along with a colleague to discuss general questions.
Was there a name?
Yes. E. Gullberg.
Blomqvist could feel the blood rush to his head.
Evert Gullberg, he said.
Blomqvist called from Café Madeleine on his anonymous mobile to book a flight to Amsterdam. The plane would take off from Arlanda at 2:50. He walked to Dressmann on Kungsgarten and bought a shirt and a change of underwear, and then he went to a pharmacy to buy a toothbrush and other toiletries. He checked carefully to see that he was not being followed and hurried to catch the Arlanda Express. The plane landed at Schiphol Airport at 4:50, and by 6:30 he was checking into a small hotel about 15 minutes' walk from The Hague's Central Station. He spent 2 hours trying to locate the Swedish ambassador and made contact by telephone at around 9. He used all his powers of persuasion and explained that he was there on a matter of great urgency. The ambassador finally relented and agreed to meet him at 10 on Sunday morning. Then Blomqvist went out and had a light dinner at a restaurant near his hotel. He was asleep by 11. Ambassador Jännerud was in no mood for small talk when he offered Blomqvist coffee at his residence on Lange Vårhut.
Well, what is it that's so urgent?
Alexander Zalachenko, the Russian defector who came to Sweden in 1976, Blomqvist said, handing him the letter from Feldin. Jännerud looked surprised. He read the letter and laid it on the table beside him. Blomqvist explained the background and why Feldin had written to him.
I can't discuss this matter, Jännerud said at last.
I think you can.
No, I can only speak of it with the Constitutional Committee.
There's a great probability that you will have to do just that. But this letter tells you to use your own good judgment.
Feldin is an honest man.
I don't doubt that. And I'm not looking to damage either you or Feldin. Nor do I ask you to tell me a single military secret that Zalachenko may have revealed.
I don't know any secrets. I didn't even know that his name was Zalachenko. I only knew him by his cover name, Ruben.
but it's absurd that you should think I would discuss it with a journalist.
Let me give you one very good reason why you should, Lundquist said, and sat up straight in his chair. This whole story is going to be published very soon, and when that happens, the media will either tear you to pieces or describe you as an honest civil servant who made the best of an impossible situation. You were the one Feldian assigned to be the go-between with those who were protecting Zarachenko. I already know that. Yenerud was silent for almost a minute.
Listen, I never had any information, not the remotest idea of the background you've described. I was young. I didn't know how I should deal with these people. I met them about twice a year during the time I worked for the government. I was told that Reuben, your Zarachenko, was alive and healthy, that he was cooperating, and that the information he provided was invaluable. I was never privy to the details. I had no need to know.
Blomqvist waited.
The defector had operated in other countries and knew nothing about Sweden, so he was never a major factor for security policy. I informed the Prime Minister on a couple of occasions, but there was never very much to report.
I see.
They always said that he was being handled in the customary way and that the information he provided was being processed through the appropriate channels. What could I say? If I asked for clarification, they smiled and said that it was outside my security clearance level. I felt like an idiot.
You never considered the fact that there might be something wrong with the arrangement?
No, there was nothing wrong with the arrangement. I took it for granted that Seppo knew what they were doing and had the appropriate routines and experience. But I can't talk about this.
Yanarud had by this time been talking about it for several minutes.
Okay, but all this is beside the point. Only one thing is important right now.
What?
The names of the individuals you had your meetings with.
Yanarud gave Blomqvist a puzzled look.
The people who were looking after Zarachenko went far beyond their jurisdiction. They've committed serious criminal acts, and they'll be the subject of a preliminary investigation. That's why Feldin sent me to see you. He doesn't know who they are. You were the one who met them.
Yenerud blinked and pressed his lips together.
One was Evert Gulberg. He was the top man.
Yenerud nodded. How many times did you meet him?
He was at every meeting except one. There were about 10 meetings during the time Feldin was Prime Minister.
Where did you meet?
In the lobby of some hotel. Usually the Sheraton. Once at the Amaranth on Kungsholmen, and sometimes at the Continental Pub.
And who else was at the meetings?
It was a long time ago, I don't remember.
Try.
There was a Clinton, like the American president.
First name?
Frederick. I saw him 4 or 5 times.
Others?
Hans von Rottinger. I knew him through my mother.
Your mother?
Yes, my mother knew the von Rottinger family. Hans von Rottinger was always a pleasant guy. Before he turned up out of the blue at a meeting with Gulberg, I had no idea that he worked for Seppo.
He didn't, Blomqvist said. Yenerud turned pale. He worked for something called the Section for Special Analysis, Blomqvist said. What were you told about that group?
Nothing. I mean just that they were the ones who took care of the defector.
Right. But isn't it strange that they don't appear anywhere in Seppo's organizational chart?
That's ridiculous.
It is, isn't it? So how did they set up the meetings? Did they call you, or did you call them?
Neither. The time and place for each meeting was set at the preceding one.
What happened if you needed to get in contact with them? For instance, to change the time of a meeting or something like that?
I had a number to call.
What was the number?
I couldn't possibly remember.
Who answered if you called the number?
I don't know. I never used it.
Next question. Who did you hand everything over to?
How do you mean?
When Feldin's term came to an end, who took your place?
I don't know.
Did you write a report?
No. Everything was classified. I couldn't even take notes.
And you never briefed your successor?
No.
So what happened?
Well, Feldin left office and Olo Ulsten came in. I was told that we would have to wait until after the next election. Then Feldin was re-elected and our meetings were resumed. Then came the election in 1985. The Social Democrats won, and I assumed that Palmer appointed somebody to take over from me. I transferred to the Foreign Ministry and became a diplomat. I was posted to Egypt and then to India.
Blomqvist went on asking questions for another few minutes, but he was sure that he already had everything Yanrud could tell him. 3 names. Frederick Clinton, Hans von Rottinger, and Evert Guldberg, the man who had shot Zalachenko. The Zalachenko Club. He thanked Janrud for the meeting and walked the short distance along Lange Vorhut to Hotel des Andes, from which he took a taxi to Centrale. It was not until he was in the taxi that he reached into his jacket pocket and stopped the tape recorder. Berger looked up and scanned the half-empty newsroom beyond the glass cage. Holm was off that day. She saw no one who showed any interest in her, either openly or covertly. Nor did she have reason to think that anyone on the editorial staff wished her ill. The email had arrived a minute before. The sender was editorial@aftonbladet.com. Why Aftonbladet? The address was another fake. Today's message contained a JPEG, which she opened in Photoshop. The image was pornographic. A naked woman with exceptionally large breasts, a dog collar around her neck. She was on all fours and being mounted from the rear. The woman's face had been replaced with Berger's. It was not a skilled collage, but probably that was not the point. The picture was from her old byline at Millennium and could be downloaded off the net. At the bottom of the picture was one word, written with the spray function in Photoshop. Whore. This was the ninth anonymous message she had received containing the word whore, sent apparently by someone at a well-known media outlet in Sweden. She had a cyber stalker on her hands. The telephone tapping was a more difficult task than the computer monitoring. Trinity had no trouble locating the cable to Prosecutor Ekstrom's home phone. The problem was that Ekstrom seldom or never used it for work-related calls. Trinity did not even consider trying to bug Ekstrom's work phone at Police HQ on Kungsholmen. That would have required extensive access to the Swedish cable network, which he did not have. But Trinity and Bob the dog devoted the best part of a week to identifying and separating out Ekstrom's mobile from the background noise of about 200,000 other mobiles within half a mile of police headquarters. They used a technique called random frequency tracking system. The technique was not uncommon. It had been developed by the U.S. National Security Agency and was built into an unknown number of satellites that performed pinpoint monitoring of capitals around the world, as well as flashpoints of special interest. The NSA had enormous resources and used a vast network in order to capture a large number of mobile conversations in a certain region simultaneously. Each individual call was separated and processed digitally by computers programmed to react to certain words, such as terrorist or Kalashnikov. If such a word occurred, the computer automatically sent an alarm, which meant that some operator would go in manually and listen to the conversation to decide whether it was of interest or not. It was a more complex problem to identify a specific mobile. Each mobile had its own unique signature, a fingerprint, in the form of the phone number. With exceptionally sensitive equipment, the NSA could focus on a specific area to separate out and monitor mobile calls. The technique was simple, but not 100% effective. Outgoing calls were particularly hard to identify. Incoming calls were simpler because they were preceded by the fingerprint that would enable the phone in question to receive the signal. The difference between Trinity's and the NSA's attempting to eavesdrop could be measured in economic terms. The NSA had an annual budget of several billion US dollars, close to 12,000 full-time agents, and access to cutting-edge technology in IT and telecommunications. Trinity had a van with 60 pounds of electronic equipment, much of which was homemade stuff that Bob the dog had set up. Through its global satellite monitoring, the NSA could train highly sensitive antennae on a specific building anywhere in the world. Trinity had an antenna constructed by Bob the dog, which had an effective range of about 500 yards. The relatively limited technology to which Trinity had access meant that he had to park his van on Bergsgatan, or one of the nearby streets, and laboriously calibrate the equipment until he had identified the fingerprint that represented Ekstrom's mobile number. Since he did not know Swedish, he had to relay the conversations via another mobile to Plague, who did the actual eavesdropping. For 5 days, Plague, who was looking more and more hollow-eyed, listened in vain to a vast number of calls to and from police headquarters and the surrounding buildings. He heard fragments of ongoing investigations, uncovered planned lovers' trysts, and taped hours and hours of conversations of no interest whatsoever. Late on the evening of the fifth day, Trinity sent a signal which a digital display instantly identified as Ekstrom's mobile number. Plague locked the parabolic antenna onto the exact frequency. The technology of RFTS worked primarily on incoming calls to Ekstrom.
Trinity's parabolic antenna captured the search for Ekstrom's mobile number as it was sent through the ether. Because Trinity could record the calls from Ekstrom, he also got voice prints that Plague could process. Plague ran Ekstrom's digitized voice through a program called VPRS, Voice Print Recognition System. He specified a dozen commonly occurring words, such as OK or Salander. When he had five separate examples of a word, he charted it with respect to the time it took to speak the word, what tone of voice and frequency range it had, whether the end of the word went up or down, and a dozen other markers. The result was a graph. In this way, Plague could also monitor outgoing calls from Ekstrom. His parabolic antenna would be permanently listening out for a call containing Ekstrom's characteristic graph curve for one of a dozen commonly occurring words. The technology was not perfect, but roughly half of all the calls that Ekstrom made on his mobile from anywhere near police headquarters were monitored and recorded. The system had an obvious weakness. As soon as Ekstrom left police headquarters, it was no longer possible to monitor his mobile, unless Trinity knew where he was and could park his van in the immediate vicinity. With the authorization from the highest level, Ed Clint had been able to set up a legitimate operations department. He picked four colleagues, purposely selecting younger talent who had experience on the regular police force and had been only recently recruited to SIS. Two had a background in the fraud division, one had been with the financial police, and one was from the violent crimes division. They were summoned to Ed Clint's office and told of their assignment, as well as the need for absolute secrecy. He made plain that the investigation was being carried out at the express order of the Prime Minister. Inspector Figueroa was named as their chief, and she directed the investigation with a force that matched her physical appearance. But the investigation proceeded slowly. This was largely due to the fact that no one was quite sure who or what should be investigated. On more than one occasion, Ed Clint and Figueroa considered bringing Mortensen in for questioning, but they decided to wait. Arresting him would reveal the existence of the investigation. Finally, on Tuesday, 11 days after the meeting with the Prime Minister, Figueroa came to Ed Clint's office.
"I think we've got something.
Sit down.
Evert Gulberg. One of our investigators had a talk with Marcus Erlander, who's leading the investigation into Zalachenko's murder. According to Erlander, SIS contacted the Göteborg police just 2 hours after the murder and gave them information about Gulberg's threatening letters."
"That was fast."
"A little too fast. SIS faxed 9 letters that Gulberg had supposedly written. There's just one problem."
"What's that?"
"Two of the letters were sent to the Justice Department, to the Minister of Justice, and to the Deputy Minister."
"I know that."
"Yes, but the letter to the Deputy Minister wasn't logged in at the department until the following day. It arrived with a later delivery."
Ed Clint stared at Figueroa. He felt very afraid that his suspicions were going to turn out to be justified. Figueroa went implacably on.
"So we have SIS sending a fax of a threatening letter that hadn't yet reached its addressee."
"Good Lord,"
Ed Clint said. "It was someone in personal protection who faxed them through."
"Who?"
"I don't think he's involved in the case. The letters landed on his desk in the morning, and shortly after the murder he was told to get in touch with the Göteborg police."
"Who gave him the instruction?"
"The chief of Secretariat's assistant."
"Good God, Monica. Do you know what this means?" "It means that SIS was involved in Zalachenko's murder."
"Not necessarily. But it definitely does mean that some individuals within SIS had knowledge of the murder before it was committed. The only question is, who?"
"The chief of Secretariat."
"Yes, but I'm beginning to suspect that this Zalachenko club is out of house."
"How do you mean?"
"Mortensen. He was moved from personal protection and is working on his own. We've had him under surveillance around the clock for the past week. He hasn't had contact with anyone within SIS as far as we can tell. He gets calls on a mobile that we cannot monitor. We don't know what number it is, but it's not his normal number. He did meet with the fair-haired man, but we haven't been able to identify him."
Ed Clint frowned. At the same instant, Anders Berglund knocked on the door. He was one of the new team, the officer who had worked with the financial police.
"I think I've found Evert Gulberg," Berglund said.
"Come in,"
Ed Clint said. Berglund put a dog-eared black-and-white photograph on the desk. Ed Clint and Figueroa looked at the picture, which showed a man that both of them immediately recognized. He was being led through a doorway by two broad-shouldered, plain-clothes police officers.
the legendary double agent, Colonel Stig Wennerström. This print comes from Olen and Åkerlund Publishers and was used in Se magazine in the spring of 1964. The photograph was taken in the course of the trial. Behind Wennerström you can see three people. On the right, Detective Superintendent Otto Danielsson, the policeman who arrested him.
Yes?
Look at the man on the left, behind Danielsson. They saw a tall man with a narrow moustache who was wearing a hat. He reminded Ed Clinth vaguely of the writer Dashiell Hammett. Compare his face with this passport photograph of Gullbeck, taken when he was 66. Ed Clinth frowned.
I wouldn't be able to swear it's the same person.
But it is, Berglund said. Turn the print over. On the reverse was a stamp saying that the picture belonged to Olen and Åkerlund Publishers and that the photographer's name was Julius Estholm. The text was written in pencil. Stig Wennerström flanked by two police officers on his way into Stockholm District Court. In the background, O. Danielsson, E. Gullberg, and H. W. Franke.
Evert Gullberg, Figueroa said. He was SIS.
No, Berglund said. Technically speaking, he wasn't, at least not when this picture was taken.
Oh?
SIS wasn't established until 4 months later. In this photograph, he was still with the security police.
Who's H. W. Franke? Figueroa said.
Hans Wilhelm Franke, Ed Clinth said. Died in the early 90s, but he was assistant chief of the security police in the late 50s and early 60s. He was a bit of a legend, just like Otto Danielsson. I actually met him a couple of times.
Is that so?
Figueroa said.
He left SIS in the late 60s. Franke and P.G. Winger never saw eye to eye, and he was more or less forced to resign at the age of 50 or 55. Then he opened his own shop.
His own shop?
He became a consultant in security for industry. He had an office on Stureplan, but he also gave lectures from time to time at SIS training sessions. That's where I met him.
What did Winger and Franke quarrel about?
They were just very different. Franke was a bit of a cowboy who saw KGB agents everywhere, and Winger was a bureaucrat of the old school. Winger was fired shortly thereafter. A bit ironic, that, because he thought Palmer was working for the KGB.
Figueroa looked at the photograph of Gullberg and Franke standing side by side.
I think it's time we had another talk with Justice,
Ed Clinth told her.
Millennium came out today, Figueroa said.
Ed Clinth shot her a glance.
Not a word about the Zalichenko affair, she said.
So we've got a month before the next issue. Good to know. But we have to deal with Blomqvist. In the middle of all this mess, he's like a hand grenade with a pin pulled.
Chapter 17. Wednesday, June 1st. Blomqvist had no warning that someone was in the stairwell when he reached the landing outside his top-floor apartment at Bellmansgarten 1. It was 7 in the evening. He stopped short when he saw a woman with short, blonde, curly hair sitting on the top step. He recognised her right away as Monica Figueroa of SIS, from the passport photograph Karim had located.
"Hello, Blomqvist,"
she said cheerfully, closing the book she had been reading. Blomqvist looked at the book and saw that it was in English, on the idea of God in the ancient world. He studied his unexpected visitor as she stood up. She was wearing a short-sleeved summer dress and had laid a brick-red leather jacket over the top stair.
"We need to talk to you," she said.
She was tall, taller than he was, and that impression was magnified by the fact that she was standing 2 steps above him. He looked at her arms, and then at her legs, and saw that she was much more muscular than he was.
"You spend a couple of hours a week at the gym," he said.
She smiled and took out her ID.
"My name is
Monica Figueroa, born in 1969, living on Pontoniergatan on Kungsholmen. You came from Borlänge, and you've worked with the Uppsala police. For 3 years you've been working in SIS, Constitutional Protection. You're an exercise fanatic and you were once a top-class athlete, almost made it onto the Swedish Olympic team. What do you want with me?"
She was surprised, but she quickly regained her composure.
"Fair enough," she said in a low voice. "You know who I am, so you don't have to be afraid of me."
"I don't."
"There are some people who need to have a talk with you in peace and quiet. Since your apartment and mobile seem to be bugged, and we have reason to be discreet, I've been sent to invite you."
"And why would I go anywhere with somebody who works for SEPO?"
She thought for a moment.
"Well, you could just accept a friendly, personal invitation.
or if you prefer, I could handcuff you and take you with me." She smiled sweetly.
"Look, Blomqvist, I understand that you don't have many reasons to trust anyone from SIS, but it's like this. Not everyone who works there is your enemy, and my superiors really want to talk to you. So which do you prefer, handcuffed or voluntary?"
"I've been handcuffed by the police once already this year, and that was enough."
"Where are we going?"
She had parked around the corner, down on Prusgrand. When they were settled in her new Saab 9-5, she flipped open her mobile and pressed a speed dial number.
"We'll be there in 15 minutes.
She told Blomqvist to fasten his seatbelt and drove over Slussen to Östermalm and parked on a side street off Artillerigatan. She sat still for a moment and looked at him.
"This is a friendly invitation, Blomqvist. You're not risking anything."
Blomqvist said nothing. He was reserving judgment until he knew what this was all about. She punched in the code on the street door. They took the elevator to the 5th floor, to an apartment with the name Martinson on the door.
"We've borrowed the place for tonight's meeting," she said, opening the door. "To your right, into the living room."
The first person Blomqvist saw was Torsten Edklinth, which was no surprise, since Seppo was deeply involved in what had happened, and Edklinth was Figueroa's boss. The fact that the Director of Constitutional Protection had gone to the trouble of bringing him in said that somebody was nervous. Then he saw a figure by the window, the Minister of Justice. That was a surprise. Then he heard a sound to his right and saw the Prime Minister get up from an armchair. He hadn't for a moment expected that.
"Good evening, Herr Blomqvist," the PM said. "Excuse us for summoning you to this meeting on such short notice, but we've discussed the situation and agreed that we need to talk to you. May I offer you some coffee or something else to drink?"
Blomqvist looked around. He saw a dining room table of dark wood that was cluttered with glasses, coffee cups, and the remnants of sandwiches. They must have been there for a couple of hours already.
"Ramlosa," he said.
Figueroa poured him a mineral water. They sat down on the sofas as she stayed in the background.
"He recognized me and knew my name, where I live, where I work, and the fact that I'm a workout fanatic," Figueroa said to no one in particular.
The Prime Minister glanced quickly at Edklinth and then at Blomqvist. Blomqvist realized at once that he was in a position of some strength. The Prime Minister needed something from him, and presumably had no idea how much Blomqvist knew or did not know.
"How did you know who Inspector Figueroa was?"
Edklinth said. Blomqvist looked at the Director of Constitutional Protection. He could not be sure why the Prime Minister had set up a meeting with him in a borrowed apartment in Östermalm, but he suddenly felt inspired. There were not many ways it could have come about. It was Armansky who had set this in motion by giving information to someone he trusted, which must have been Edklinth, or someone close to him. Blomqvist took a chance.
"A mutual friend spoke with you," he said to Edklinth. "You sent Figueroa to find out what was going on, and she discovered that some Seppo activists are running illegal phone taps and breaking into my apartment and stealing things. This means that you have confirmed the existence of what I call the Zelichenko Club. It made you so nervous that you knew you had to take the matter further, but you sat in your office for a while and didn't know in which direction to go. So you went to the Justice Minister, and he in turn went to the Prime Minister. And now here we all are. What is it that you want from me?"
Blomqvist spoke with a confidence that suggested he had a source right at the heart of the affair, and had followed every step Edklinth had taken. He knew that his guesswork was on the mark when Edklinth's eyes widened.
"The Zelichenko Club spies on me, I spy on them," Blomqvist went on, "and you spy on the Zelichenko Club. This situation makes the Prime Minister both angry and uneasy. He knows that at the end of this conversation awaits a scandal that the government might not survive."
Figueroa understood that Blomqvist was bluffing, and she knew how he had been able to surprise her by knowing her name and bio.
"He saw me in my car on Bellmansgarten. He took the registration number and looked me up. But the rest is guesswork."
She did not say a word. The Prime Minister certainly looked uneasy now.
"Is that what awaits us?" he said. "A scandal to bring down the government?" "The survival of the government isn't my concern," Blomqvist said. "My role is to expose shit like the Zelichenko Club."
The Prime Minister said,
"And my job is to run the country in accordance with the Constitution, which means that my problem is definitely the government's problem,
but not vice versa.
Could we stop going around in circles? Why do you think I arranged this meeting?
To find out what I know and what I intend to do with it.
Partly right, but more precisely, we've landed in a constitutional crisis. Let me first say that the government has absolutely no hand in this matter. We have been caught napping, without a doubt. I've never heard mention of this, what you call the Zalachenko Club. The minister here has never heard a word about this matter either. Torsten Edklinth, an official high up in SIS who has worked in SEPO for many years, has never heard of it.
It's still not my problem.
I appreciate that. What I'd like to know is when you mean to publish your article, and exactly what it is you intend to publish. And this has nothing to do with damage control.
Does it not?
Herr Blomqvist, the worst possible thing I could do in this situation would be to try to influence the shape or content of your story. Instead, I am going to propose a cooperation.
Please explain.
Since we have now had confirmation that a conspiracy exists within an exceptionally sensitive part of the administration, I have ordered an investigation.
The PM turned to the Minister of Justice.
Please explain what the government has directed.
It's very simple, said the Minister of Justice. Torsten Edklinth has been given the task of finding out whether we can confirm this. He is to gather information that can be turned over to the Prosecutor General, who in turn must decide whether charges should be brought. It is a very clear instruction, and this evening Edklinth has been reporting on how the investigation is proceeding. We had a long discussion about the constitutional implications. Of course, we want it to be handled properly.
Naturally, Blomqvist said, in a tone that indicated he had scant trust in the Prime Minister's assurances. The investigation has already reached a sensitive stage. We have not yet identified exactly who is involved. That will take time. And that's why we sent Inspector Figueroa to invite you to this meeting.
It wasn't exactly an invitation.
The Prime Minister frowned and glanced at Figueroa. It's not important, Blomqvist said. Her behaviour was exemplary. Please come to the point. We want to know your publication date. This investigation is being conducted in great secrecy. If you publish before Edklinth has completed it, it could be ruined.
And when would you like me to publish? After the next election, I suppose.
You decide that for yourself. It's not something I can influence. Just tell us so that we can know exactly what our deadline is.
I see.
You spoke about cooperation, the PM said. Yes, but first let me say that under normal circumstances I would not have dreamed of asking a journalist to come to such a meeting.
Presumably in normal circumstances you would be doing everything you could to keep journalists away from a meeting like this.
Yes, but I understand that you're driven by several factors. You have a reputation for not pulling your punches when there's corruption involved. In this case there are no differences of opinion to divide us.
Aren't there?
No, not in the least. Or rather, the differences that exist might be of a legal nature, but we share an objective. If this Zalachenko Club exists, it is not merely a criminal conspiracy. It is a threat to national security. These activities must be stopped, and those responsible must be held accountable. On that point, we would be in agreement, correct?
Blomqvist nodded.
I understand that you know more about this story than anyone else. We suggest that you share your knowledge. If this were a regular police investigation of an ordinary crime, the leader of the preliminary investigation could decide to summon you for an interview. But as you can appreciate, this is an extreme state of affairs.
Blomqvist weighed the situation for a moment.
And what do I get in return, if I do cooperate?
Nothing.
I'm not going to haggle with you. If you want to publish tomorrow morning, then do so. I won't get involved in any horse trading that might be constitutionally dubious. I'm asking you to cooperate in the interests of the country.
In this case, nothing could be quite a lot, Blomqvist said. For one thing, I'm very, very angry. I'm furious at the state and the government and SEPO and all these fucking bastards who for no reason at all locked up a 12-year-old girl in a mental hospital until she could be declared incompetent.
Lisbeth Salander has become a government matter, the PM said, and smiled.
Mikhail, I am personally very upset over what happened to her. Please believe me when I say that those responsible will be held accountable. But before we can do that, we have to know who they are.
My priority is that Salander should be acquitted and declared competent.
I can't help you with that. I'm not above the law, and I can't direct what prosecutors and the courts decide. She has to be acquitted by a court.
Okay, Blomqvist said.
You want my cooperation. Give me some insight into Ed Clint's investigation, and I'll tell you when and what I plan to publish.
I can't give you that insight. That will be placing myself in the same relation to you as the Minister of Justice's predecessor once stood to the journalist Ebbe Carlson.
I'm not Ebbe Carlson, Blomqvist said calmly. I know that. On the other hand, Ed Clint can decide for himself what he can share with you within the framework of his assignment.
Blomqvist said.
I want to know who Evert Gulberg was.
Silence fell over the group.
Gulberg was presumably for many years the chief of that division within SIS which you call the Zalachenko Club, Ed Clint said.
The Prime Minister gave him a sharp look.
I think he knows that already, Ed Clint said by way of apology.
That's correct, Blomqvist said. He started at Seppo in the 50s. In the 60s he became chief of some outfit called the Section for Special Analysis. He was the one in charge of the Zalachenko affair.
The PM shook his head.
You know more than you ought to. I would very much like to discover how you came by all this information, but I'm not going to ask.
There are holes in my story, Blomqvist said. I need to fill them. Give me information, and I won't try to compromise you.
As Prime Minister, I'm not in a position to deliver any such information, and Ed Clint is on very thin ice if he does so.
Don't bullshit me. I know what you want, and you know what I want. If you give me information, then you'll be my sources, with all the enduring anonymity that implies. Don't misunderstand me. I'll tell the truth as I see it in what I publish. If you were involved, I would expose you and do everything I can to ensure that you were never re-elected. But as of yet, I have no reason to believe that is the case.
The Prime Minister glanced at Ed Clint. After a moment, he nodded. Blomqvist took it as a sign that the Prime Minister had just broken the law, if only of the more academic type, by giving his consent to sharing classified information with a journalist.
This can all be solved quite simply, Ed Clint said. I have my own investigative team, and I decide for myself which colleagues to recruit for the investigation. You can't be employed by the investigation, because that would mean you would be obliged to sign an oath of confidentiality. But I can hire you as an external consultant.